Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to have back in the House David Satter, one of the great authorities on Russia and before it the Soviet Union. These days, he is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a visiting scholar at my alma mater, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He is the author of numerous books, including most recently, The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep: Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin, and is always a welcome guest here, but especially on the eve of the upcoming debate. David Satter, welcome back. Good to have you.
Oh, well, thank you, Frank.
So let's talk, because I suspect it won't be a subject of the debate, but should inform what is said there, with a topic that I know you've given a great deal of thought to, and some of it really based in part on your superb personal record as an investigative journalist, how it came to pass that we are now dealing with Vladimir Putin. Who is this man, David, in your estimation, and how did he get to be president of Russia?
I think he is a more or less typical representative of the KGB at the working level. Not high level, not at the command level, but at the working level, the people who carried out the commands, who unthinkingly followed orders, who accepted the idea that the state is all important and that the individual counts for nothing, and the idea that they themselves count for nothing. In the changed circumstances that came over the Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union, people like that went into business, and they were able to enrich themselves. Either they went into business as a result of getting some type of political office, as Putin did, being appointed as he was to the position of the head of the Committee of Foreign Economic Relations of the city of St. Petersburg, or money that had been sequestered was used to start them in business in banks or in companies. But in any case, the outlook that they took with them from the KGB was preserved. And the essence of that outlook is that people are expendable. And that the lives of individuals don't amount to anything. What counts is the interests of those who are in power. And this was displayed by Putin throughout his career. One of the things that recommended him to Yeltsin was his role in setting up what's called a honey trap for the prosecutor general of Russia, who was investigating Yeltsin's corruption. The prosecutor was filmed with two prostitutes, and that film was put on national television and used as a basis for removing him from office, although the real reason was to prevent the investigation. And when Yeltsin was looking around for someone to protect him after the end of his second term in power, at a time when his popularity rating was 2%, he turned to a practiced KGB operative who had demonstrated his loyalty in the past and who could be counted on to keep his commitments to those in power and not to think too much about the welfare of ordinary people. And that was Vladimir Putin.
There's also this matter of the Chechen wars, and I'd like you to talk quickly about that, because I do want to talk a bit more about where we are with respect to Russia as it will likely play out in the course of this debate. But this is such an important data point about the nature of the man we're up against, and whether there is in fact someone there with whom we can safely do business.
That's the key point, because the second Chechen War, the first Chechen War was started by Yeltsin in order to improve his popularity ratings, which it suffered as a result of the so-called economic reforms. But the second war was started for another reason, to make sure that Putin was put in power. And the only way it was possible to do that was to organize the bombings of apartment buildings in Moscow and other Russian cities. And even though those bombings were blamed on Chechens, the evidence is overwhelming and incontrovertible that they were carried out by the FSB, the Russian intelligence service, on behalf of Yeltsin's entourage and ultimately Putin, who, due to the popularity he gained as the leader of this war effort, which was supposedly waged to avenge those terrorist acts, was able to become president.
When you look at what has happened as a result, it would seem to me, of the sustained miscalculation about Putin. First, George W. Bush, who looked into his eyes and saw his soul, and then Obama, but specifically Hillary Clinton, who engaged in this so-called reset policy. How would you say those mistakes on the part of American policymakers have contributed to Putin's growing aggressiveness and the threat that arises therefrom?
Well, it's part of deterrence is psychological deterrence. And if your adversary believes you don't understand him, he believes you can be manipulated, and believes that the false impression that he's foisting on you is the impression that you take literally, obviously you're going to have a much harder time keeping him under control. In situation after situation, and actually began with the first Clinton administration, or with Bill Clinton, if we have a second, I don't know. But when proof materialized that the bombings had been carried out by the Russian leaders themselves, the United States accepted what were obviously false explanations. And that was instrumental in burying the truth about what had really happened. So we're complicit, really, in fooling ourselves and weakening ourselves.
When you look at what Hillary did with respect to this uranium deal with Russia, what are the strategic implications of that, as well as the transactional costs, if I could call it that?
You know, Russia is involved really in facilitating the nuclear ambitions of Iran. And anything that, you know, any partnership with Russia is a partnership that whose long-term consequences and broader consequences can't really be predicted. As a result, you know, we shouldn't be involved with them in strategic deals. And that's even if the connection is not direct, the indirect connection is extremely important. I mean, the mere fact, for example, that the Russians were involved in the Bushehr reactor, which was considered to be for peaceful purposes, did not prevent know-how from specialists and from the process of developing a peaceful reactor from being used ultimately for military purposes.
David Satter, let me just ask you quickly, when you look at what is now going to confront the next president of the United States, whomever that might be, how would you characterize the challenge Russia will pose to us as a result of the Obama-Clinton legacy?
Well, Russia is an unstable country, even though it appears stable, and the leadership understands it, and they fear their own people. And the best way for them to control the situation inside the country is to organize the population against the outside world, particularly against the U.S. And therefore, they don't need a reason to be aggressive. They're looking for reasons. And this is something that the United States will have to confront, because they will attempt to raise tensions. They will attempt to create incidents. and they will attempt to bully their neighbors. And only a strong position on the part of the U.S. can deter them.
David Satter, thanks so much for joining us. Next up, we'll drill down a little bit more on that deterrence issue with Mark Schneider, one of the country's foremost experts on Russia and others' nuclear threats to the United States. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Dr. Mark Schneider, I'm very pleased to say, is with us to talk about this issue of deterrence that we addressed briefly with our previous guest, David Satter. A psychological condition, to be sure, but one that we've spent an enormous amount of effort and treasure trying to assure is reliable as well as safe and effective, specifically our nuclear forces. We'll talk with Dr. Schneider, who is one of the country's preeminent experts on such matters. But I want to begin with an area that he's particularly knowledgeable about, and that is the Russian nuclear weapons buildup and the threat that it represents to us. Dr. Schneider is a man I've had the privilege of knowing for 30 years, having worked with him in the Pentagon. One of the country's not only duty experts on these subjects, but also one of its prime practitioners. Dr. Schneider, welcome back. You're now with the National Institute for Public Policy, and you have been reporting on what the Russians are up to. Give us a sort of overview of the threat as you see it now emanating from the Kremlin.
Well, we have a military and nuclear threat, and we have a political threat coming out of the Kremlin right now. The Russian media is fanning fears of nuclear war right now in Moscow, supposedly over Syria. The Russians are building up their strategic nuclear forces as fast as they can. The latest set of numbers that have been released under the New START treaty and their Russian numbers have the Russians up approximately 250 warheads above the New START limits. It's supposed to go into effect legally in February 2018. When they started this process in 2011, they were below the New START limit. So the net effect of New START has been a substantial increase in Russian capabilities, while U.S. capabilities have declined very significantly. We're down over 450 deployed strategic nuclear warheads compared to what we had.
Our guest is Dr. Mark Schneider of the National Institute for Public Policy. And Mark, you were just making the point that as a result, or at least under the rubric of this so-called New START agreement, we've seen a reversal of fortunes, in a manner of speaking, between the Russians and the United States. Give us a sense of what, besides the numbers, we're looking at in terms of enhanced Russian nuclear capabilities, seemingly very much designed to threaten us.
Well, both the quantitative and qualitative increase in Russian strategic nuclear capabilities will continue literally forever. I mean, there's no end point in it. It's a question of when they finish a modernization program, they start a new one. So we're going to see this. There are approximately 20 plus new or improved strategic nuclear delivery vehicles that have been formally announced by the Russians, and there are one or two others that have been reported in the Russian press, but not formally announced. We have two replacement systems on a very leisurely development path right now. They won't be available until close to 2030 in one case, and after 2030 in another case.
If then, depending on funding and a lot of other political decisions along the trail.
Absolutely. Almost all of the proposed modernization programs of the Obama administration are under attack by the American left, and Hillary Clinton, according to a recording of a speech he made at a fundraiser, opposes at least one of our most important nuclear modernization programs. So this is a very important election from that standpoint. The significance of the modernization is that the Russians will increasingly have capabilities that we will lack in a qualitative sense. And that's dangerous because they think that gives them a big advantage, and we should basically back down in front of their threats. And they're going to make a lot of threats. In my prediction, in 2017, Putin will ratchet up the pressure on the next president very, very significantly.
Mark, let me ask you about, in connection with this New START treaty, you're now saying that, as I understand it, it is, quote, highly unlikely unquote, that the Russians will comply with this treaty, this much ballyhooed legacy of the Obama-Clinton years. We've also had a taste just recently of them shredding another agreement, this one involving plutonium. Is there any reason to really think at this point that that New START is going to be treated differently by the Russians down the road?
No, I think that both of the agreement and the treaty you just mentioned, their attitudes toward compliance come from the same basic motivation. They are trying to maximize their nuclear power and generate fear of their willingness to use nuclear weapons in the West. One standard Russian threat that's been going on for over 15 years is a threat to tear up arms control agreements. They just did that with the nuclear the plutonium disposition agreement. They just tossed it away.
The Obama administration has been doing its level best in that regard. You've mentioned earlier reductions in our nuclear forces. If you would, talk quickly about two other things, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and the prospect that it will use the United Nations to try to circumvent the Senate in a form of ratification of it, and this idea of adopting a no-first-use nuclear policy.
Well, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty has a distinction, before the Iran agreement, to be the only arms control agreement that was voted down by a majority of the U.S. Senate. It is that bad. It has very serious verification problems. Despite that, we have a substantial evidence, even in the Russian press, that the Russians are cheating on this, that they are conducting low-yield nuclear tests, and that plays a role in their development of new types of nuclear weapons, which have actually been announced by the Russian Defense Ministry. So Obama's here is clearly trying to do an end run of the United States Senate, and I suspect he will push on with that.
Perhaps after the election, though, rather than before, I guess.
Certainly. I mean, he's not going to do anything, probably anyway, before the election, because he's afraid that there may be a reaction to it.
It is indeed. Lastly, in 30 seconds, Mark, the no first use policy, he seems to have gotten some significant pushback from his own Secretary of Defense on that idea. Do you think it's over the side?
At this point, yes, but that could reverse after the election. I wouldn't at all be surprised if that's the case. I know this is being fought by senior officials, including Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Air Force, in the Pentagon. But the Obama White House, unfortunately, is composed of different types of people, and they may actually do something bad on this. And
we'll be following it closely, as I know will you. Mark Schneider, we have to leave it at that. Senior fellow at the National Institute for Public Policy, one of the country's great corporate minds and memories on this whole issue of nuclear forces and deterrence. I hope you will keep up your good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll be talking with Bill Gertz. We'll get into some of these issues as part of his weekly tour with us inside the ring.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Barack Obama has long engaged in a wrecking operation against America's armed forces. In the past week, however, we've received fresh proof of the scale of his destructiveness against the only military we have. Last week, a serving female Marine officer questioned his decision to put women into ground combat roles, since doing so will harm them and their unit's mission performance. The commander-in-chief showed himself ignorant of or simply indifferent to these facts. Then on Wednesday, he told all the government's national security agencies that, quote, our greatest asset, unquote, in keeping America safe is, quote, the diversity of our national security workforce, unquote. Not military power, not superior weapons, not well-trained and highly motivated troops. Diversity. So now, instead of honing their warfighting skills, our warriors must train to heighten diversity-promoting intersectionality, whatever that is. God bless and help our troops. This is Frank Affney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our tour Inside the Ring. That is, of course, the title of the prize-winning column by our guest, Bill Gertz, also a senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon. Man, we turn to each week for his insights into what's going on inside the national security establishment of the United States and threats there, too. Bill Gertz, welcome back. Always good to have you, as usual.
Hi, Frank. Always good to be on the show.
Thanks. Let's just pick up on a point that you've touched on in a piece where you actually quote our previous guest, Dr. Mark Schneider. What do you make of the Russian nuclear buildup, Bill, and Mark's contention that he thinks it's now on a glide path to break out of the so-called New START Treaty, one of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama's great legacies, we're told?
Yeah, this is a really, really important story. I went back, and I don't think I mentioned it in my piece on the Russians adding 61 new warheads to their arsenal, but the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in February testimony to the House Appropriations Committee talked about not just the strategic nuclear buildup by the Russians, but the tactical nuclear buildup. And what's really alarming about the Russian nuclear forces is they are developing something called low-yield nuclear weapons. That is, usable nuclear weapons. These are unconstrained by any treaties, non-proliferation, comprehensive test ban, New START does not cover these. And they're actually developing yields of somewhere around the 10 tons to 100 tons, as opposed to kilotons in nuclear yield. And so this is really alarming, and it just hasn't gotten the attention it does, what the Russians are doing with an across-the-board military buildup. All legs of their triad are being modernized. At the same time, the U.S. is cutting hundreds of nuclear warheads and urgently needs to modernize its nuclear forces, or they're not going to be of deterrent value.
Yeah. In the course of the debate this Sunday night, I anticipate that we'll hear again from Hillary Clinton, as we have both from her and her vice presidential running mate, Tim Kaine, criticism of Donald Trump's views with respect to a possible Japanese nuclear arsenal. You've discovered that the Pentagon has actually been giving some serious thought to that possibility. What did you find?
Yeah, this is a report in the Free Beacon today. It's based on a Pentagon study that was done in June of this year, where the net assessment study of Japan's potential nuclear force is quite alarming, in the sense that it outlines the reasons behind why Tokyo would seek a nuclear capability, and that would be because they're doubting the extended deterrence, which the U.S. has used as a nuclear umbrella to protect Japan. It's clear that the Japanese have detected weak U.S. leadership, and they're also looking at the fact that our nuclear arsenal is aging and in dire need of modernization. So those are two factors which really could lead to the nuclearization of Japan, and that would also trigger South Korea also to probably go nuclear.
The third consideration for both the Japanese and the South Koreans would, of course, also be the burgeoning capabilities of China to engage in nuclear attacks against them. And one of the things that this net assessment study in the Pentagon's think tank, as it's been called, is the possibility that the exchange ratios would be very unfavorable to Japan, but they nonetheless may feel no choice but to acquire a nuclear deterrent to contend with it.
Yes, the study said, based on nuclear experts' assessment, is that Japan would have to go to deterrence by punishment. In other words, to be able to inflict comparable nuclear and population damage on China that China would inflict on Japan. And so that's a kind of a dire assessment, in considering the disparities in populations of the two countries.
I attended a conference here in Washington yesterday hosted by the Washington Post, in which there was discussion of the various cyber dangers we're facing at the moment. One of the things that was quite stunning to me, frankly, were the comments of two non-governmental panelists on a part of the program to discuss the threats to our critical infrastructure, in which the audience was told that we're doing pretty well vis-a-vis threats from cyber attack as far as our critical infrastructure, including the electric grid, is concerned. You have been following this very closely, I know, for some time, and particularly looking at China's cyber threats and this deal that doesn't seem to have done much to attenuate them, that President Obama completed with Xi Jinping. Talk a little bit about that that threat vector as you see it, and particularly the vulnerability of our electric grid and other critical infrastructure.
Well, yeah, clearly, you know, they say that in warfare, the first casualty is truth. And as I argue in my forthcoming book, we're really in the middle of an information war, and China has really been attacking us relentlessly on the information front for years now, and nothing has been done to counter it. Instead, the Obama administration sought to reach some feckless agreement that doesn't really cover the issue at all. The idea that was concluded in September of 2015 to stop government-sponsored economic cyber espionage. Well, the government-sponsored economic espionage is all that China does, and they give that information to their state-run corporations. The U.S. doesn't do that. But yet they try to say that this was a great agreement. I reported in my Inside the Ring column in the Washington Times not too long ago that since that agreement, an American software company was hacked by the Chinese government, and 1.7 terabytes of data was stolen, proprietary information. So it's clearly not working, and we've got to get to a much stronger position to counter this Chinese information warfare campaign.
In the course of the debate on Sunday night, I wonder whether Donald Trump will use as an example of the kind of corruption that he has charged Hillary Clinton with, evidence that you've just reported about some sweetheart deals that Hillary seems to have been trying to arrange for a friend of her daughter Chelsea's. Tell us what's up with that and whether you think it warrants that kind of attention in the presidential debate.
It certainly does. This is a major investigative report that I did for the Free Beacon, which was based on Hillary Clinton's emails. And they show that 7 years ago, when she first became Secretary of State, she went to bat for her daughter's best friend, a woman named Jacqueline Neumeier Deal, who was a Pentagon consultant, and tried to get this consultant to expand her contacts beyond the Office of Net Assessment, which we talked about earlier, into the key policymaking arms of both the Pentagon and the State Department. The State Department policy planning staff turned down her request for contracts, but she seemed to get a little bit further with the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in trying to get contracts there, although the Pentagon says that it didn't happen. But it shows the kind of cronyism and potential ethics violations that Hillary was willing to do, use her position. We've already seen a lot of that as it relates to the Clinton Foundation and State Department policymaking. Now we've seen it at the Pentagon.
The state of the FBI's investigation of this email scandal, it turns out, as I understand it, they've now acknowledged that they've lost several boxes of these emails. What on earth is going on with the Bureau?
It's clear that the political influence was put on this FBI investigation to limit its scope and clearly to dismiss it for political reasons. I think that's really what we're looking at. And there were a number of boxes of materials. This is coming out in what they call the 302 FBI reports. And there are boxes of these documents that were missing. So the question is, well, what happened to them? My question is, where is our congressional oversight? Where is our judiciary committees calling for an investigation, a special prosecutor to look into this? I think that's really what's needed.
Bill, thank you for being on the job all of the time and for joining us to talk about the great work you do. Next up, Diana West joins us. We'll talk a little bit more about what to expect from the debate with respect to the question of whether to import more jihadists. That more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hello, I'm Ace Lyons. As a retired 4-star admiral who served as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, is a special privilege for me to talk to you about an important new book just released by the Center for Security Policy, China Prepares for Conflict, and Why We Must Do the Same. The book explains that while the Obama administration has dithered over the deterioration of the Middle East and ignored Asia, China has been moving to challenge and displace the dominant role the United States has played in this region and the world since the end of World War II. I am one of 9 co-authors of this important book. The others are former Senator Jim Talent, Gordon Chang, Peter Navarro, Kevin Freeman, Bill Gertz, Frank Gaffney, Fred Flights, and Dean Chang. I explained in my chapter how China's efforts over the last 20 years to seize control of almost the entire South China Sea is an indication of new assertiveness to advance its regional dominance at the expense of the United States. I take issue with President Obama's benign neglect of the threat from China and how Beijing is building islands in the South China Sea that it plans to turn into stationary aircraft carriers to threaten freedom of navigation in this region. Like the other authors of this book, I believe the next president must act immediately to restore American leadership and its military power, both of which have been seriously undermined by the disastrous policies of President Obama. We urgently need to modernize and increase the size of our land, naval, and air forces to stand up to China and other adversaries worldwide. We also need to recognize and counter the growing cyber and intelligence threats from China. The bottom line is that our nation needs to act now. I strongly commend this important book, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same. You can read it for free as an ebook on the Center's website, securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the high privilege of being each week by Diana West, a longtime and extraordinary syndicated columnist, now blogging with great effect at dianawest.net. She's also the author of 2 terrific and best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana, welcome back. It's always good to have you. There's a lot to talk with you about.
Let's start indeed
with the issue that I suspect will be part, I certainly pray it will be part of the debate on Sunday, and that is differences between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump about the jihad, the global jihad, and what we had best do about it. I know you are a Trump partisan, but give us as best you can your sense of, well, not just what they're going to talk about, but what they should talk about. What's really at issue here?
I think it starts, and this is the basis of Donald Trump's appeal from the very beginning, with the American border, the borders of the United States. And while we talk about the global jihad, we have jihad here. And what we missed in the past 15 years since 9/11 is attention to how to stop the incursion of the jihad into the West, into America specifically. And this is when Donald Trump talks about wanting to be the president of the United States and not the president of the world, that I think the focus, sort of the fulcrum of his appeal, is encapsulated. And so this is part of his immigration policy. It's part of his national discussion on how to prevent Islam from coming into the United States and setting up a demographic for Sharia, for Islamization. And what I hope comes up in the debate, and I hope comes up in his conversation, is a very clear picture of the results of Islamic immigration. And the place we look in living color, in lurid detail, in statistical hard numbers, is what is going on in Europe, across Europe, as we've seen a mass incursion really over the past several decades, but certainly concentrated in the last couple of years, into all the European countries of many Muslims coming from the Middle East and Africa and others that have absolutely transformed and Islamized much of the continent and certainly all the big cities.
We really do have the microcosm of Europe as a test bed for what is in store for us if we don't follow what I think of as the eminently commonsensical policy of not importing more jihadists into this country. We have, as you say, plenty of them already here. That is a point on which there is, of course, a profound difference between Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump. I anticipate that Hillary will once again inveigh against Trump's efforts to shut the door on Muslims or keep out people from states where terrorism is a problem and the like. But I would think that is an issue on which the vast majority of Americans are actually sufficiently commonsensical that they're likely to be more aligned with Donald Trump on it.
I think they are, but I think the strategy against Donald Trump's policies is this relentless press to demonize this effort to protect our liberties from being Islamized. And this comes about where we are told that we are bigots and racists and phobes of all measure, bad people, for wanting to, for example, prevent 65,000 Syrian refugees from coming into this country, which is part of Mrs. Clinton's program. She not only wants to push amnesty on probably tens of millions of illegal aliens who are already here, but she wants to open really the proverbial floodgates to all manner of dislocated peoples from mainly the third world, from mainly the Islamic world, into the United States as a means of alleviating misery. Now, Donald Trump will say, I think we should help these people as we can, unspecified. However, we should do it in safe zones closer to their own regions. We should also, and this is a very important point of his, policy point, we should also persuade our friends or not friends in the Islamic world to take up the slack on this and provide safe spaces for people who are currently victimized by various wars, wars that will continue no matter how many refugees we take into this country. I mean, this is a point I thought that our friend Ann Corcoran made at her wonderful blog, Refugee Resettlement Watch, yesterday, I think it was, very well. She was talking about the fact that wars in Africa, wars in the Middle East, civil wars, struggles, internecine struggles, tribal struggles, national struggles, will not stop because the West takes in 500,000 refugees. These are chronic problems. However, we can help them if that's what the people decide to do, if they want to be humanitarian, but we should help them over there. We should not allow our own countries to be riven by these same struggles. I mean, the fascinating, horrifying thing is when you see refugee camps in Europe at the moment now becoming little civil wars as Afghans fight Turks, as Pakistanis fight Moroccans. I mean, this is not just in the camps, this is now happening in the, on the streets of Switzerland and other European countries, as these Islamic tribes war on just different soil, in the sort of mosaic of violence that they bring that bears on, of course, the natives of these various countries and against each other. I mean, we are importing violence.
Yesterday, there was an extraordinary press conference by the FBI, which hasn't exactly covered itself in glory lately, a subject we were talking about earlier with Bill Gertz. But Diana, talk, if you would, a bit about this event and what the FBI now is averring about this fellow Adan.
Yes, well, I have a confession to make, which I really kind of startled me. I forgot about this attack, and that's a terrible thing, not just about my brain, but just about these are starting to become commonplace in America. This was a knife jihad at a shopping mall in Minnesota by a 22-year-old, the Don, who went on a rampage. He wounded 10 people before he was shot dead by an off-duty police officer. Now, what was extraordinary about this press conference by the FBI was the discussion of the knifeman shouting Allahu Akbar during the attack, the discussion that he may have been radicalized. I mean, they were not in the same sense that we're used to dancing around the whole concept of Islam being the driving factor in this attack of jihad, this jihad attack in Minnesota. It was mentioned, and this is something that Gates of Vienna, our friends over at Gates of Vienna, pointed out, and I think it's a very valid point. But the larger point about our security and also about the difference between Trump and Clinton is that Mrs. Clinton's policies will bring in more people like this. Not that every single one of them is going to go on a knife jihad. That's not the point. The point is that violence is part of Islam, as our friend Noni Darwish has explained to us so brilliantly in terms of the normalization of violence within Islam, in the private sphere and the public sphere, the governmental sphere. And so this is what you can expect with Islamic immigration, and this is what we see, not just in the United States, where attacks so far seem to be relatively sporadic in this larger sense, although really they are becoming more frequent, and we really need to start understanding that. But in Europe, it is now a way of life. It is a way of life that women and girls are no longer safe on the streets of cities where policemen not so long ago did not even have guns. So this is the change that we have witnessed in our lifetime, and it is a change that certainly in the last generation is strictly Islamic. It is the Islamization of the West, and we see it a step ahead of us in Europe due to the demographic weight of this immigration recently, and we see it happening here. And the biggest difference between Clinton and Trump is that Trump wishes to stop this. He wishes to stop this immigration. Mrs. Clinton wishes to accelerate it.
Anna, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.